Good evening. Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on board for this live show on the 21st of July, 2020. Thank you very much for spending some of your Tuesday evening with me. And we've got a packed show tonight, a lot to get through. The story, of course, is that we're going to touch on our households' confidence data, which we've updated based on the latest information, and also our property scenarios. And we'll also cover a lot of other stuff too. So without further ado, I just want to go through the running order, which essentially is this introduction, just the house rules as normal about our models, some key slides, and then some questions and answers. The Q&A will take up the bulk of the show, of course, and then we'll sign off probably around 9:30 plus or minus, and depending a little bit on what you want to talk about and what you want to ask me. In terms of the house rules, just let me make the normal point that please understand this is not financial advice. This is based on my own analysis, my own thinking about what's going on, but it's not formal financial advice. If you need that, go to a financial advisor. They can tailor advice to your particular circumstances. Please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. Plexus is doing his thing again. Really appreciate your help, Plexus. Thanks very much for that. And this is as at the 21st of July, 2020. So if you're watching this in replay, many years into the, you know, down the future, you'll be able to know whether we got it right, whether we got it wrong, or somewhere in between. If you want to get my attention later on, use @walktheworld. Just to explain, for the first part of the show, where I'm actually going through my slides, I don't look at the chat. So if you've got specific questions that you'd like to ask me, then hold off until I come to the Q&As a little bit later. Just it makes it easier to manage the flow of the conversation. I have enabled Super Chat, and in fact, Ron has already made a contribution in before 8 o'clock. Thanks, Ron. I appreciate that. You can make a contribution directly via the Super Chat, or also make sure that your question goes to the top of the list and gets noticed. Every dollar that we actually have contributed to us goes right back into making more content. We don't make any profit out of what we do here. This is all about sharing information, insights, and helping people understand more about what's going on. And that's what this show is all about. Now, in terms of the model, there are some people who may not have seen this before. Those of you who've been on the show regularly will always know. This is because it's important to understand that DFA is not based on just opinion or hearsay. It's based on research. And the cornerstone of the research is our household surveys, our rolling 52,000 household surveys. We talk to 4,500 each month and add those into the data. So each week we get another 1,000 data points. And that means that we can have a really good up-to-date chat about what's going on. We then put that into our core market model, and the core market model is then what drives the YouTube. It drives my analysis through a DFA blog and also work for clients. So that's the way that the system works. We can also slice and dice the data lots of different ways. And what that means is it's like a Rubik's Cube. We can look at it, dimensionality around property, around households, around location, or other dimensions too. 120 elements in the model. And some people actually do like to get hold of the model. In fact, if you're via Patreon, if you get the right tier, you can actually get access to that model. Now, in terms of the RBA minutes today, there wasn't a huge amount of new stuff, but basically they just said that household consumption had declined. Well, we sort of knew that, and they think it's going to decline further in June. I would agree with that from what I'm seeing in my data. I have to say that, you know, the information coming out from the Reserve Bank is a little bit out of date insofar that they're relaying minutes, which was before the Melbourne lockdown. So in a way, it's a bit behind the times, but nevertheless, it's quite interesting. Imports and exports are both low. We've seen that in the trade numbers. I covered those a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, imports are differentially more depressed, which means that the trade numbers are being flattered at the moment, but that's because there's low activity here in Australia. Another thing about jobs, so about 835,000 people have lost their jobs over 2 months. The unemployment rate has risen. They said 7.1%, which is, of course, the ABS one, but Frydenberg Desai said it's closer to 11.3%, and I think that's probably closer, and even that's probably understating the true situation. And it's also because a lot of people left employment in May and didn't actively search for work. As for employment, total hours are also pretty much down, although they do say that it's closer to a 10% rather than 20% fall. And we'll see about that, given the fact that we've now got lockdown down south. Housing prices declined somewhat. Vacancy rates increased sharply in Melbourne and Sydney. The housing sector looks pretty dodgy at the moment. We'll touch on this a bit later. Funding costs of the Australian banks are very low, and that's, of course, partly because of the Reserve Bank's facilities and the fact that they've been manipulating the yield curve of the 0.25% out to 3 years. And they've basically concluded that they're happy with what they're doing and that the policy packages continue to work broadly as expected. So that may be good news. It may not be good news. It's difficult to say, really, but that's anyway what they said. Now, in terms of the Governor Lowe's speech today, it was quite interesting because he actually went into some detail on some quite important points, this speech that came out late this afternoon. First thing he said was that, the unemployment and hours worked, you can see it dropping off a cliff and then recovering a little. But this really just tells you how far below the trend we now currently are. And with what's happening in Melbourne, we would expect that to continue, I think, ahead. Also, look at this, the RBA bond purchases, pretty much no purchases since early May. And that's because they've been able to effectively control the yield curve without necessarily needing to do that. But this is quite interesting. He talked about using the central bank's balance sheet. And this was a conversation around MMT, essentially, because there's a lot of discussion in the country and in the media about MMT and, should we be looking to try and facilitate fuller employment using effectively government money. And he's basically said no. The reality is there's no free lunch. You might do that, but there are quite a lot of risks attached. And he actually went on to say that the debt across all levels of government in Australia is relative to the size of our economy is quite low. It's quite lower than many other countries. And therefore, it will remain so. And what that really says is, look, there is fiscal space. The government can do things. And therefore, there is a significant limit on what the Reserve Bank is intending to do. So that basically puts a bit of a dampener on those who were expecting massive MMT to come out of the back of what's going on at the moment. I think that's quite interesting. Well, I found it so anyway. Now, in terms of JobKeeper, this is the data that came out in the report. So the Treasury report today basically included some quite interesting information. And essentially, you can see there that the unemployed numbers dropped by 838,000. The hours worked dropped as well. The number of persons working 0 hours compared to February was up by over 306,000. The number of people working fewer hours was 863,000. The number of unemployed rose from 693 to 927. And the number of people not in the labour force rose by 726,000. Now, that last number is very significant because that, of course, is hidden in the unemployment numbers, which is why, in fact, the employment number is actually definitely higher than what is the official figure. Now, JobKeeper and JobKeeper has been extended and tapered. This came out today. It's worth saying that Frydenberg said it's a 100-year event with 2 million Australians losing their jobs and saw the hours reduced. Effectively, 11.3% unemployment is his estimate. Of course, if you count underemployment, then you're probably looking somewhere around 18%, which is huge. And this is something to understand. This is not going to get cured anytime soon. Generally, it takes years for unemployment to recover. And I don't think it'll be different this time. And all talk of a snapback and a V-shaped recovery has now dissipated. JobKeeper has been paid out to around 960,000 businesses, and therefore on to about 3.5 million employees. And they've paid out at the moment about 30 billion. Remember that this was originally about 130 billion estimated. So they haven't paid out a huge proportion yet. They're going to pay out more. Just under half were female recipients, they said. And of course, it's the flat payment. And they've now said the existing arrangement will end at the end of September. But it will be extended to the 28th of March. But it'll be reduced. And they're going to reduce it from 1,500 to 1,200 per fortnight. Or, and this is new, they basically said there are people who are part-time workers and now they'll get under 20 hours as at February 2020, and they're going to get 750. So you can see that what they're trying to do is to answer a criticism they had, which a lot of people who are working part-time previously got a whole load of additional money, and in fact quite a large number if you look at the report. So they're trying to sort of tailor it back to that. And then they said for the last quarter, for the quarter up to the end of March, it'll drop again to $1,000 per fortnight or $650 a fortnight. And they estimate the cost will be around $16 billion, making the total cost for JobKeeper around $86 million. And what they're basically saying is that 3.6 million employees will drop by at least 2 million between now and the end of March. That's what their estimation is showing them. And of course, the question is, well, what happens to them? Are those people back in work, or are those people effectively on job seeker rather than job keeper? And that, I guess, is the big unknown question at the moment. There are some assumptions they've made, but also those assumptions are a very high level and they've not been clearly articulated. They may be more articulated on Thursday, but we'll see. Now, in terms of the turnover test, so what this is now very important. So the business will need to prove every quarter that they actually had either a 30% or a 50% drop in turnover, depending on their size and other factors. And they basically are assuming that 1.4 million workers in the December quarter and 1 million in the March quarter will be using it. So you can see how it's tapering away, both in terms of the value and the count. Seems a bit optimistic to me, but we'll see, I guess. Job seeker will also change. So it's going to be reduced in September from $1,100 to $800. And the revised job seeker program will allow recipients to earn a small amount, $300 per fortnight, before facing reduction payments. That's going to cost an additional $4 million. But there is going to be a mutual obligation now. And that means that essentially they are going to have to access employment services and go for 4 job searches. And they'll increase the job search in September and also bring the assets test back in, plus liquid assets and the waiting period, all those things. So in other words, they've tightened this up dramatically. And so a number of people who potentially are on job seeker now may find themselves being squeezed off it. They also did make the point that more decisions will be taken later in the year, and it's likely to continue beyond December. And at the moment, the COVID-250 supplement is going to end in December. So that's basically what they announced today. So tapering, JobKeeper, JobSeeker, both still to exist. My own theory is that they will have to continue both programs until after the election, let's say not this October, but next October. And we're going to see some switching between people who were employed but on 0 hours with JobKeeper moving to JobSeeker, and some people who are on JobSeeker may get squeezed out. So I think we're going to see some quite difficult times ahead, and they are expecting unemployment to continue to rise. And the budget is in October, so this is the budget they promised earlier in the year and then didn't deliver it. Thursday is just an economic statement, so I'm not sure how much detail we'll go in through there. And of course, I'll cover it and we'll discuss it on the channel. Now, in terms of SMEs, this is quite an important. This is from UBS. So that UBS has done some analysis, and I've done some analysis too using my SME surveys. And the SME sector is looking pretty compressed at the moment. On average, SME revenue fell 27% in the year to year to June. And that's potentially an estimating that they made of around $100 billion of stimulus is going to be removed. And what that could suggest, that 48% of SMEs are likely to reduce employees if JobKeeper payments not extended. Well, they are going to be extended, but they're going to be tapered down. And, you know, this is going to have an impact on SMEs. So some SMEs will find it harder and harder probably to keep going, particularly if we get a wave two of the virus. And there's also an issue with regard to bank losses, because, of course, the banks are quite reliant on the mortgages that SMEs have taken to support the financing they've got. So all of those things are in the mix. The UBS data, I think, is quite powerful. CoreLogic, by the way, is back. It was down yesterday. We got zero change yesterday, but it's back today. But you can see there that the home price data is down in each capital city day over day. And other than Adelaide is now down over the quarter, and Melbourne down 3.18%. I can think that, or but that we will see more falls ahead. SQM made the point that the auction clearance rates were much lower than those officially published by Domain and CoreLogic. So that's Sydney at 48, Melbourne at 31.5%. And I think their calculations are certainly much more in line with what I think is really happening compared with those other reports that are actually published. Now, in terms of one of the conversation points I've had quite often is, yeah, but this is all very high level. Give me some examples. So I'm going to do that today. And shout out to Cookie Boy, who's been looking out some of these data points. And in fact, in this show and next week, we're going to go this into more detail. But here's a worked example of a property. This is actually in Seven Hills in New South Wales, which is for sale. Any estimates of what you think it might be worth? Well, it's advertised at $720,000 at the moment. It's three beds, one shower, two parking spaces or a garage or whatever. But what's interesting is that the property last changed hands in August 2016 at $735,000. Now, this is what I keep seeing, and this is a really important illustration. We are seeing areas where even the asking prices are significantly lower than the last sold price from a few years ago. And if you think about August 2016, since then, most prices in Sydney would have expected to have gone up, right? But in fact, here, no, not going up. And I think that's very important to understand. So when you look at granular data, you see very different things from the top-level summaries and top-level indices. And Edwin and I, next week at this time, we'll be live talking about this in more detail. So mark your diaries for the 28th. Edwin will be back on with me. And we've got his audio fixed, I think, now. So it should be much easier to listen to. But we're going to go through some more examples because I think this is a really powerful way of getting at what's really going on. Now, here's another example. Just up in Queensland, people say, never talk about Queensland. So here's one from Kincora in Queensland, where the median price in that area is $279,000. So quite a lot lower than elsewhere. And this is one that came across my desk today, a mortgagee house in Kincora. Come onto the market with an asking price of $255,000. It's got four bedrooms, three bathrooms, a lock-up garage, and it's on a 706 square metre block. The house was built in 1980. It was last sold in 2010 for, wait for it, $439,000. And the median price in that location today is $279,000. And so, as the headline said, mortgage house listed for $180,000 loss. Now, I'm seeing that in lots of places, not just in Queensland, in particularly regional Queensland, but in lots of other places too. So, again, I want to underscore that the story that prices have gone up everywhere, or that there's nothing to see about losses in property, is wrong. When you go granular, you see something quite different. And just one other data point, there was another report today from ANZ CoreLogic on rental listings. And this is really important because, of course, the rental sector is tied to the property investment sector. And what they showed was that total rent listings are 16.3% higher. And this is the 4 weeks ending the March the 15th and June the 28th. And new rent listings are up 5.6%. In Sydney, they're up 3.4% or 0.9% for new listings. And in the ACT, this is really interesting, up 9.6% for new listings. So you can see some stresses and strains in those markets with regard to the rental sector. Now, others, not so difficult, listings are down. But overall, the annualised growth in rents has been subdued at 0.9% across the capital city markets for the past 5 years. That's a big deal. And that's one of the reasons why I believe that the property investment sector is going to take a bath. Now, the Roy Morgan confidence data was out and down, declined by 1% today. And they basically said that it's to do with Melbourne's lockdown and Sydney's rising case numbers, probably is. Not as bad, of course, as the drop in mid-March, which is what you'd expect, but it's still a bit of a worry. And they said, though, that current finances have actually risen since May, despite an overall confidence down being 8%. So that's interesting. Not sure what to make of that. But the point there is that consumer confidence is definitely relatively weak. And mortgage stress, I showed you this slide last time. I haven't updated it, but 39.1%. I can tell you that the latest data that I'm seeing at the moment, which I'll report in 2 weeks' time, is even higher. But what I am going to do is focus on the Household Financial Confidence Index. So this is another part of my survey where we ask people about where they are today compared with a year ago on a number of different dimensions. And so the overall index is actually down. It's down at 76.9. And you can see there that it's actually dropped. So relative to what we had a significant drop, and then we had a bit of a bounce back, and now it's dropped again. And of course, that drop is directly correlated with what's happening with the virus in both Victoria and New South Wales. But what's interesting is when you start drilling into it. So here's the, So one of the really interesting things here is the confidence by our wealth segment. So in fact, those who are called free affluence without mortgages, with property, with stocks and shares, have done a little better. So they've seen the stock markets rise. So they're feeling a little confident, but they're below the hundreds, which means they're still below where they were long-term average. But those with a mortgage and those renting both are seeing falls in their overall financial confidence. Now, this is confidence relating to their financial affairs, income, costs, net worth, savings, all of those things. We can also look at it in terms of the states, and there you can see there's some quite different movements. Some of the smaller states, like Western Australia, South Australia, and even Queensland to an extent, are not looking so bad. They've moved up slightly, but New South Wales and specifically Victoria have dropped significantly. So this shows me that the latest round of virus is definitely having an impact. Also, if you look at it by property segment, you can see here that property investors, you know, if you go back to 2016, they were on top of the world. They were above the average, feeling very confident about their property investments. And it's been sliding ever since. And it's now really rock bottom. Never seen it as low as that ever. And that's because we've got rental compression. We've got issues with financing and a bunch of other things. And of course, with property prices falling, there's no capital growth as well. So that's a big deal. And also those with property owners occupied is not too bad. It's still low, but it's not dropping. But the property inactive households are also down a little bit, and that's a combination of the rental stress and the difficulties of making rental payments. Now, if you look at it across the age groups, you also see there's quite interesting things going on. So the younger groups, so the 30 to 40s and 20 to 30s, have seen the most significant fall, whereas those in the next couple of age brackets, a little less so, and those at 60 plus down a little. So basically we're seeing the lump in the middle, and that's because there's less mortgages in that sector. They've got more assets behind them. They've got more stocks and shares and other things. So that's one of the reasons why we're seeing. But look, it's still way down. Remember that 100 is the neutral setting. 100 is where we should expect to see if everything is fine, and we're way below that. Now, if you look into the individual elements, job security, you can see how that jumped up. So effectively less secure, just below 70, down a little now. So there's a little bit of good news there, but from a very low base. And very few people feeling more secure, just a slight uptick, and about the same. If you look at income pressures, you'll see that, again, incomes have fallen for 65% of households. It's gone up again, and that's a combination of jobs being squeezed, hours being squeezed, people out of work, all those things. And very, very few have actually seen any tangible rise in incomes. And I think that's quite significant. And some are saying, well, it's little change, about 30%, but this is the big one. And that, of course, flows directly on to paying the mortgage and other things. Then if you look at the cost of living, you can see there that the cost of living have risen dramatically. It's been a steady rise all the way back from 2015 onwards, and it's still rising. So the costs The CPI doesn't actually represent anything like reality for most people. And with the income compression that we've spoken about, it doesn't surprise me that the costs are the problem as well. Debt remains an issue, so there's a big spike in terms of those feeling less comfortable. It went up dramatically once COVID hit. It's come back just a little, but it's still very high, more than 60% of households saying, those with debt, that they're really worried about the debt that they've got, very high compared with previously. And as a result, those feeling more comfortable, quite low, about 5%. Those about the same, sitting around 30%. So this is a big deal, particularly if those are mortgages, and particularly if those mortgages are relating to investment properties. Savings also are under pressure, and that's a combination. You can see there the less comfortable orange one there, just below 60%. And that's a combination of savings where on deposit the returns are very low. There was a bit of an issue with dividend payments. Of course, the stock markets themselves are up quite a lot, but dividends are way down and some banks aren't paying dividends. And that's actually hitting quite a few people and will hit a few people ahead. So they're worried about that. And what it means is that people are tapping into their savings to make ends meet. And of course, that can't go on forever. Net worth, therefore, if you put it all together, so income, expenditure, asset values, all those things, has your net worth increased or decreased? The answer is that for more than 65% of households, it's now lower than it was 12 months ago, compared to under 20% who are saying it's about the same and it's higher. And there's really very little hope, I think, that that's going to improve anytime too, because I think the property prices will continue to drift a little lower. I think the stock markets, which of course were up dramatically, in fact, over today, and it's been up over a little last few weeks, to the point where it's probably significantly overvalued. Obviously, the announcement about the Oxford trials were, seen as a real positive, but remember, there's a long time between phase one trials and treatments coming through to into the field, as it were. So I'm not as bullish as some on that. So the markets, I think, are overvalued, and we'll be talking about that again in some future shows. Now, in terms of the scenarios, and just to remind everybody, this is driven off the core market model. So this is a set of mathematical relationships based on all the information that I've got. So it isn't me just sort of dropping a number in a computer. It's actually driven off the back of the algorithms that I use. So, and it's different scenarios, because scenarios help you to understand a bit about what's going on. It doesn't say this, it's not a prediction. It's not saying it's going to be like this. It's going to say, here is a range of things that could happen. What's the relative weighting based on what my model is saying? And it's really watching the change over time, and it's looking at the relative distribution between different scenarios. It's worth, of course, saying that we've assumed that the COVID thing is going to be a six-month episode. I think that's probably a bit optimistic now. It's could well run for longer, but at the moment, I think the data is not clear enough. Once we know whether, in fact, Victoria comes out of lockdown in 4 or 5 weeks, or whether it actually has to go further, and whether New South Wales gets locked down again, those are the open questions. So it could definitely make the scenarios worse ahead. Anyway, if we start with the RBA baseline, so this is what I think the RBA is thinking. So basically, they're thinking that over the next couple of years, we're going to see unemployment around 7%, probably. Might be a little bit lower than that, but that's what I think they're probably thinking. And there's a probability, a 5% probability, that there could be a very small rise in house prices, maybe 5% up or 5% down. But I've now given that a 5% probability. Remember, a couple of shows ago, we were at 20%. So you can see how that's really come down in recent analysis. In terms of the best case, so this is what I think people would hope for, if they were really honest about it. Very low rates, higher unemployment, higher mortgage stress, and small drops in home prices. A number of the economists are talking about those sorts of ranges, 5 to 15%. I give that a 20% rating, so no change. But I'm now veering more towards what I call the longer-term crunch, where, again, we have very low rates, so I think the Reserve Bank is likely to take rates a bit lower from where they are. Unemployment will stay higher. Mortgage stress will be significantly higher than it is at the moment, 42%. The losses will start ticking up, and home prices could be down 15% to down 30%. And I think that's a reasonably realistic set of scenarios. I now give that a 45% chance. So that has now become, if you like, my central scenario. There is also the broader question of, do you really get a second wave, not just here but around the world? And if so, what would that do? Well, if we did get a significant second wave internationally as well as here, then, you know, the unemployment rate will be higher, the stress levels will be higher, the home price falls will be higher, there'll be more bail-ins and bail-outs and all sorts of weird things going on. Still got 25% on that, and that hasn't really changed. And then I've got my uncontrolled pandemic. So if the whole thing falls apart and effectively the controls don't come, the virus gets away, the testing doesn't actually lead to the ability to be able to deal with the virus in terms of the injection programs and those things, the immunizations. What that means is that there's a risk that we could get very significant economic damage over a long term in multiple geographies. And in that scenario, we're looking at a very, very sickly case. But I only give it a 5% chance. My own feeling is it's going to be somewhere between best case and longer term crunch. But I've certainly tuned my scenarios down based on the data to something like a longer term crunch. So I think unemployment will be higher for the next 1 to 2 years. Home prices will be lower for the next 1 to 2 years. Economic activity will be cramped. SMEs will be in some difficulty. So there you go. That's my latest analysis. Okay, with that done, I'm now going to come back to the Q&As, and we'll have a bit of a discussion around some of the things that people have been talking about. Let's have a look. Just looking down the list. There's interesting sidebars. Now, there was a question that was asked a couple of times, and I'm just going to answer that question right up front because it's quite an interesting and important question. And it's a question relating to the issue of bank protection. And one of the interesting questions was, what about foreign banks? Are they actually protected under the financial claims scheme? And the answer is, it rather depends on which bank you're talking about. This is actually the page from APRA that lists the authorised deposit-taking institutions covered under the financial claims scheme. And, of course, the financial claims scheme protects account holders of ADIs in one or more accounts up to a total of $250,000 per relationship. What I mean by that is, if you actually have St. George and Westpac accounts, it's counted as one relationship because it's one banking license. Here is the list. It's quite a long list. I'm not going to read them all out, but you can go and have a look yourself. But you can see there that there are, you know, Arab Bank Australia, AMP Bank, so some of the smaller ones as well as the big ones. Some of the overseas organisations who have a banking license here in Australia are covered. So Citigroup is covered under the scheme. People like Cuscal, the Defence Bank, Gateway Bank, the old building society, they're all there. A lot of building societies, credit unions are. ING Bank, of course, which is a foreign outpost of a European bank, and quite a few others there as well. So if they're on this list, and of course this list is updated from time to time, then your institution is definitely protected. I'd also make the point that Jin Bank Limited is on the list there. So that's just another one to make a note of. The point, though, is if your financial institution is not on this list, then you need to ask them a few important questions, because it's important, I think, to make sure that you have protection where it's available. The 250k, of course, has to be activated by the government, so it's a theoretical guarantee, but that's how you find out whether there are banks who are protected or not. APRA does have all that information on their website, and if you type in the financial claims scheme or APRA financial claims scheme, you'll go straight to this list, and they ask a whole bunch of questions as well. Different banking licenses, are your deposits checked? There's actually a tool there that you can use as well. So hope that helps to answer that particular question. Okay. Now, this was one comment that came up from Hot Dog. I can't see the government honouring the 250k guarantee in the current climate. Well, it's very interesting you should say that, because, of course, the real question is they've got to activate it. Now, and the original scheme was designed for a scenario where there will be one bank that might get into difficulty, and that bank could then be, in an orderly fashion, basically managed through and could be dealt with. That was what was very much the idea. The question becomes, if you have multiple banks essentially falling over at the same time, then what do you do? And of course, we don't know. We don't know what the government would do. APRA is the custodian of the scheme, but the government has to actually trigger the 250k. So it's a nascent scheme until it's triggered, right? And that's the key point. And remember that this is a gone situation. In other words, the 250k guarantee scheme does not exist until a bank has failed. And here I just want to join the dots between that and bail-in. As you know, we've been focusing on bail-in quite recently because of the Senate inquiry on the proposed amendment to specifically exclude deposits from being bailed in. And the thing to understand is that bail-in is to do with saving a bank before it falls over. The deposit insurance scheme only comes into play when the bank has fallen over. So you could argue that in some scenarios it might actually be better for the government and APRA to encourage a bank to bail in, say, deposits, compared with allowing the bank to fail and triggering the 250k guarantee scheme. Now, who knows? What the government is saying, the Treasury is saying, APRA is saying, there is no intent, there's no way that deposits can be bailed in. So they're saying that that amendment is not required. But if you drill into it in sort of close detail, you realise that they've got a whole bunch of different elements of multiple laws all put together to try and actually deal with the scenario that we're talking about. And the view I have, and others have who've looked at this in detail, is that there are potentially ways of keeping it loosey-goosey deliberately. So, and John Hutson, people like that actually say, pass this law, it will solve the problem. That tells you that there's definitely ambiguity. And a lot of the submissions, of course, said it's ambiguous. So there's a couple of weeks. So if you have not picked up the phone and spoken to your MP and just reminded them that they should pay attention to this amendment in the Senate and the Senate inquiry around bail-in, it's worth doing it. There's plenty of material on the DFA site and on Interests of the People, the other channel that I'm involved with, as well as over on the Citizens Party. So there's plenty of information. It's worth exploring. And, my view is make a fuss, because this is an opportunity to get the deposit issue taken off the table. And just to be really, really clear, if you believe that this is all conspiracy and it'll never happen, just go over and look at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and type in open bank resolution. And there in New Zealand, you can see quite clearly an articulation of precisely how deposit bail-in works. It's live and kicking in New Zealand. It's there and available. And that, of course, is not just the only place. It's in other countries too, because it's part of a G20 agenda. It's part of a financial stability border agenda. Here in Australia, it's loosey-goosey, woolly-woolly. But that's the story about that. Okay, what else have we got? I should also say, by the way, if anybody wants a postcode, I do have the postcode database up tonight as well. That's going to set the hairs running, I suspect. Okay. Just looking down the list to see what else we've got. Okay. Interesting. Good question. How do I capture all the data in my surveys? Is there a company? Yes, I use a third-party company. I'm not going to tell you who it is, because we have a mutual NDA, because they do research on their own behalf, and they also do research for a bunch of other financial institutions and banks. And they don't necessarily want their reputation anchored to my reputation, because I'm a little bit more negative with regard to what I'm seeing than they would perhaps be in their own service. But they do the calls. It's a phone-based survey, and they have an obligation to present to me 1,000 data points each week. It comes in normally on a Tuesday. I put it in the model, update the model, and we go on from there. Okay, hocus pocus. You said 2010. All right. Well, you've let me just pull that up. I can do that. Okay, and I'll just put the data in. 2010, clear text. Okay. Didn't work, did it? Just okay. Apply. Surrey Hills. All right. This is the Surrey Hills data set. And this is basically as at today, because I had put the data in that came in today. So there are 16,000 households in Surrey Hills, of which 3,300 are borrowing, 11,800 are renting, there's 8,894 properties for rent, and there are 5,857 rental property owners. Now, those rental property owners, just to be clear, aren't necessarily owning property in that location, but that's where they live. Relatively small amounts of mortgage stress, only 8.3%, and therefore low risk of default. Rental stress is more significant, 5,249 households in rental stress at 44.42%. Anything above 35-36% worries me. But this is quite interesting. Stressed investors. So there, of that 5,000, there are 3,946 property investors who are stressed investors. In other words, they've got issues with cash flow, issues with trying to sell property, issues with vacant properties. And that's 76% of property investors living in the Surrey Hills. So there you go. That's that one. I'll just do one more. Warren, I saw yours there. Thank you very much for that contribution too. Really appreciate it. It certainly helps to get noticed. 4701. Okay. Add that and apply. 4701. Okay, so that's Coongal, Queensland University. Okay, so here, 18,379 households, of which 7,230 are borrowing, 8,341 are renting, 6,357 properties for rental, and the number of rental property owners, 5,870. Mild stress, only 905 at 12.5%. That's reasonably good. Risk of default, 205 over the next 12 months. That's quite low. Rental stress is pretty low at 2.8%. And the rentals, default over 2 months, 2.8%. Rental stress, 2,956. 35.4% in rental stress. So that's, you know, high. Anything above 30%, I get twitchy about. And from the point of view of stressed investors, 1,690, which is 30.9. So not as bad as some, but still pretty high. Okay, I hope that's of some help. I'll come and do some more postcodes a bit later. Let's just see what else is going on. Just looking down through the list of comments. Lots of side comments going on, which is good. Good to see. It's an interesting one from Dylan. People who think property prices are going to drop 20% really remind me of people who thought Bitcoin would go to 100k a couple of years back. Discuss. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing to understand about property is that we are over-leveraged. All of our debt-to-income ratios and debt-to-GDP ratios are off the scale. We've got more of the banking system leveraged into property than pretty much any other country. We've got government, of course, who supports the property sector through their you know, the home builder program and everything else to try and keep that thing. Because everyone's worried that if prices start to fall, then there's a cascading effect on the bank's capital. There's a cascading effect on household wealth. So there is a lot of wish to try and support the economy because it's so big. But, you know, we've built ourselves into this corner. And I keep saying to people, if you just keep doing the same again, in other words, putting more stimulus into the property sector and trying to keep it up again, you're just going to create a bigger problem later. We have to find a way of getting out of this hole because it is unsustainable. There is no bigger debt bubble anywhere that I know relating to property anywhere around the world. And we know that debt bubbles ultimately do burst. It's a question of whether it's a slow burst or a long burst. But unfortunately, debt can only sort of support a certain proportion, and we're way over that. If you look at the debt-to-income ratios, very interesting that the Bank of Queensland has now said that they're actually going to throttle back their debt-to-income ratios to six times. Six times, right? So there are some banks still lending seven, eight times income. And in the current environment, you've got to ask yourself, is that sensible? You know, in fact, under the hood, most of the lenders have started to throttle back. But they are, of course, also now offering interest-only periods to some borrowers to try and get help them get through. And in some cases, they're offering a restructuring of the loans to be able to actually make the loan a bit longer and those sorts of things. But of course, if unemployment is really going to be as high as we think it will be, then over the next few months, the banks are going to have hard conversations with people about their loans and their obligations. And that's why I'm expecting to see more properties coming onto the market later in the year. Okay, what else have we got? Let's have a quick look up here. Plenty of comments coming in. I just need to try and... I agree, Mel G. 6-7% of personal wealth here in property, second only to China. Absolutely crazy. Yes, and look what's happening in China. So there, did you see more banks have been nationalised quite recently? And they've reduced the capital requirements for banks to try and allow them to continue. Property prices have actually gone up in China quite recently after the COVID. And the fact that, whoops, I've just pushed another button. Let me come back to that one. So I'm just saying that the China situation is an example of what can happen. But yeah, we've got huge issues here. Laura says, how long will it take for the decrease in Social Security to impact the property market? It's a very interesting question because these things tend to take quite a long time. It doesn't sort of all happen overnight, right? If you look at the US, all of the things that happened post the global financial crisis took 2 or 3 years to really work through. So property prices started to slide a little and then started to fall in more severe terms. Over there, they also had much higher levels of unemployment. There were some changes made at that time too. So you've got to be thinking 2 to 3 years for all this all to work through. Now, some of those changes for Social Security will probably happen more quickly than that. I think there will be people who have been surviving on Job Seeker who may find that the drops now that are coming will actually tip them over the edge. I certainly see that in my data points. That's one of the reasons why mortgage stress is going to continue to rise, I think. But it's going to be a slow grind rather than actually something to be fixed. Okay, let me just go here. And then now, let's go to the next part of the question. The original question, can a foreign subsidiary bank bail in and save the main bank in the country if located in not related deposit guarantee? Thanks. Yeah, the answer is every bank in Australia has capital in Australia. And so they effectively are supported with local capital. Now, if a main bank somewhere overseas decides to do that, might do. Can a foreign subsidiary bank bail in and save the main bank in the country? So perhaps maybe you were thinking, let's take New Zealand and Australia. So if NAB got into difficulty here, could the Bank of New Zealand do that? Now, what has happened over there is that the capital in the BNZ is actually in New Zealand, not in Australia. It can't be switched across. They actually changed the rules. So it's unlikely that could happen, I think. Okay, can I put another postcode up? Yeah, let's do this one. There you go. Katrina, 5352. I still haven't learned all the postcodes off by heart. I should by now, really, shouldn't I? But 5352, add, apply. Okay, right, let's put that one up. Get rid of that so you can see it. Okay, so this is places like Bethany Rowan Flat, so inner rural South Australia. So it's a rural area, a small number of households, 2,389, 901 borrowing, 883 renting, 665 properties for rent, 539 property owners, and 37.5% in mortgage stress, 21 risking default over the next year, defaults in 12 months, 2.3%, rental stress, 120%, so that's pretty low, and property investors with difficulty, 6.5%. So the real issue here is the mortgage stress one, which is, you know, 37.5%. That's below the national average of 39 at the moment. So relatively speaking, that looks like a relatively benign environment for now. Bit of debate about that. 75% figure for China did come from Harry Dent. He keeps talking about it. And the fact of the matter is, every time I speak to Harry, he sort of builds the story of China even more. So he believes that China is going to go for the biggest bang, but then says that Australia is set for a fall as well. In fact, I'll be interviewing Harry, I think, later this week. So there'll be another Harry show coming quite soon. It'll be interesting to get his latest take on the markets, because, of course, the markets have gone up dramatically, but he always said they would go up and then would come down again. So let's see about that. Dee, I appreciate your contribution there. Thank you so much. Matt, I appreciate that contribution too. Thank you very much. A couple of beers for you and Adams. I've learned a lot from you guys. Good to hear that. We are trying to sort of share our knowledge and in our perspective, not just peddling a particular line, but actually genuinely trying to engage and raise awareness. So that's good. Dimantra, thanks for that as well, and I appreciate all those contributions. Sarah, thank you very much. 2061, let's do that now. Add, apply. Okay, so that's Kirribilli. This could be quite an interesting one. Let's put it up so you can see it. Okay, so Kirribilli, of course, in Milsons Point area of New South Wales, right on the North Shore, Lower North Shore, 3,894 households, of which 507 are borrowing, 2,773 renting. So that's very much a renting area. Properties for rent, 2,080. Number of rental property owners in the area, 1,778. There's no mortgage stress. Very little risk of default, but small. Rental stress is 32%. So, about a third of people who are renting there are in some significant issues. But this is the interesting one. 67% of investors are stressed. And I keep seeing this. So I'm seeing in the more affluent areas a considerable rise in the number of those that are actually struggling with their investment properties. It's one of the reasons why I keep saying I think we're going to see the investment property sector slide first. I think the others will probably come later, but could be wrong, but that's what I'm seeing. And it's because the investment property conundrum has really, really, fallen apart. And by the way, the ATO published their data today for 2 years ago, showing the number of leveraged properties, which had gone up by a couple of hundred thousand, and the number of people who had multiple properties, which also was up as well. So I'll probably give that a bit more of a chat about that down the track, because it's quite an interesting piece of data. Trouble is, there's so much data around the moment. Dee says, for those sitting in cash, when would be a good time to put it to work, and how and where? What options do you have? Love your show and appreciate all you do for the people. Thanks, Dee. I appreciate that. Look, this is really tricky, right? I guess there's two questions you need to ask yourself. The first question is, do you want to try and preserve or create additional value from the money you've got, right? Because your strategy is going to be quite different. My own strategy has been to recognize that there are lots of uncertainties at the moment. And so I'm more about preserving what I've got rather than actually trying to find areas of growth at the moment, because I think that cash preservation in particular is probably most significant. So my own view my own view is that it's worth just being liquid and staying liquid at the moment, because there are so many variables. We don't know how long COVID is going to run for. We don't know how serious it's going to be. We don't know what the unemployment rate's going to be. We think that unemployment is sufficiently high to put more households in difficulty, which is going to have a triggering effect on the property sector. I doubt that the government will be able to support property. So if you were thinking of buying property, it's probably worth buying later rather than now, so that you can actually perhaps get better value. So I think stay liquid. Now, there are people who say, no, go gold. Put it in gold, because at least you've got something tangible. The trouble is with gold, the price is manipulated, and it might go up, might go down, who knows. You've still got to convert it back if you want to use it later. And there are some issues of cost of carry and all those sorts of things. So gold and silver, some people really swear by it. I personally don't. And of course, others say, no, put in Bitcoin. You'll probably go up. Well, might go up, might go down. It's speculative. So at the moment, my own view is I'd just simply, stay around liquid. If you've got more cash than 250K, spread it across multiple banks so you've got the guarantee. But that's how I'm thinking about it at the moment. Okay, now did I do this one? I can't remember. David, if I've done this already, I apologise. If I haven't, I'm going to do it now. 6057, don't think I did that one. There isn't a simple way of ticking off the list, as it were, without spending a lot of time on the computer. And as you know, it's a one-man operation here. whoops. You might like to see the other way. That's the way that the whole thing works. So it's me and me and me doing all of this. And you can see there that I'll just get rid of that for a second. You can see there that's basically the way it works. So I'm controlling everything from the video through to the computers. So it's all me. That's just the way it is. Okay, now let's go back to this particular postcode, which is High Wycombe 6057. And there 6,702 households, 3,800 borrowing, 2,029 renting. Properties for rent, 1,556, and the number of rental property owners, 2,355. Mild stress, 1,520 at 40%. Risk of default, 12 months, 143, so that's 3.8%. So typically in the West, it's quite a lot higher than elsewhere. 3.8% is low for the West. I've seen 5, 6, 7 in other postcodes. 29% are in rental stress, and 32.4%. Investors are stressed. So, medium high, but the mortgage stress at 40 is definitely something to be a little bit concerned about. Okay, let's have a look. Oh, thank you, Javier. Appreciate that. Glad you like what we do. Bit of an observation here from Cookie Boys having a conversation. Net interest margins getting crunched at Bendigo. Their revised dividend is still way too high and their CET1 ratio isn't pretty. Yeah, some of the regionals are really being scrunched at the moment. Of course, they don't have the same funding capacity as some of the other players, the big players, and they are competing quite hard to try and get mortgages, but again, they're finding it quite difficult. So the regionals, I think, are going to find it really difficult ahead. Okay, here's one from 2769. Did I think I said? I will say it again. This information is right up to date because basically it's including information I received today. So this is the latest. Oh, no, it's not. What happened there? Sorry, 2769, right? Yep. 2769, edit. If I don't press the right button in the right sequence, I basically get a whole load pretty much all postcodes. 2769, is that a valid postcode? What's going on? Apply. Yes, it is, the ponds. There you go. Wish I could type. Okay, this is the ponds in urban New South Wales, urban fringe, 2769, 3,498 households, 2,934 borrowing, 962 renting, mild stress 1,778. So that's wait for it, 83.5%. Seeing that in a lot of the outer suburban areas, very high levels of mortgage stress. Risk of default, 59 at 2%. Rental stress is also very high at 55.5%. And 40.8% of investors are also stressed. So you can see there that on any dimension you look at, the ponds is definitely an area of difficulty. All right, let me just go down the list here. 2154, have I done that one? I'm not sure. Do that one again, if in case I haven't. Clear list. 2154. These lists, of course, get really, really interesting. No, I didn't. Castle Hill, there we go. 2154, JD, this is for you. Let's put that back up there so you can see it. Okay, 13,743 households, 6,559 borrowing, 4,300 renting, 3,324 properties for rent, number of rental property owners, 4,042, mild stress, 1,609, severe stress, 702, total stress, 35.2%. Risk of default, 130 or 2% in the next 12 months. Rental stress, 53.8%, which is more than 2,300 households. And 46.3% of investors in the postcode are stressed, which is more than 1,630. So again, another example of, out on the, if you like, on the urban edge, same sort of profile. Okay, Simon says 3104. Let's do that one. Just putting it in now. 3104. Apply. Okay, 3104, Baldwin North. There you go. 7,598 households, 2,854 borrowing, 2,329 renting, 1,790 properties for rent, number of rental property owners, 2,553, mild stress, 571, severe stress, 539, 38.9% in mortgage stress. And of course, mortgage stress on a cash flow basis, and money in, money out. That's how we measure it. A risk of default, 103 or 3.6% over 12 months. Rental stress, 582 at 25%. And investor stress at 30.9% at 719. So a little less than some, but still looking a little bit wobbly. Okay, now David, thank you for that. 3182 St Kilda. Come on. Yep. Apply. Okay, so this is St Kilda. 14,802 households, 3,061 borrowing, 10,950 renting, 8,162 properties for rent. There are 6,000 property rental owners in the area, 139 in mild stress, 263 severe stress, so that's 13.1%. So that's pretty low. Risk of default, pretty low too, 4.3%. So it's, a bit higher than some, but that's a relatively low number. Rental stress, that's where it counts, 5,600. 51.1%. So a lot of people in St Kilda in rented accommodation are having issues. And then you've got 67.2% of investors living in the area who've got issues. So you can assume that some of those are going to be in some financial difficulty ahead. Okay. And David said lots of Airbnbs, blue chip suburb, but that's about right. I think the reason that the investors are stressed is because of the Airbnb issue, which, of course, as you quite rightly say, is a big deal. Okay, I'm just going to have a quick look. I might sleep now. Lots tired of postcodes, says Joseph. Yeah, I know. I'm just looking at the other questions. If people ask me postcode questions, I'm going to deal with it. But I'm looking to see what other questions are. Oh, dear. Lots of postcodes. Okay, here's one. 3029. Clear list. 3029. I'm happy to answer other questions too if people have other things they'd like to talk about. I found this quite hypnotic, really, with the postcodes. Let's get rid of that. There you go. 3029. So this is Hops Crossing. I've been watching this. 30,708 households, 18,570 borrowing, 11,222 renting, property to rent 8,712, number of rental property owners 8,580, mild mortgage stress 6,360 at 34.2%, risk of default 404 or 2.2, rental stress 7,014 at 62.5%. So the real pressure point here is the rental sector in that particular postcode, particularly now, I guess. Stressed investors, 1,060 at 20%. So at the moment, investors don't seem to be too badly hit, but I'd be looking at that issue with regard to rental stress. So you might see that changing ahead. So there we go. That's that one. Yeah, Nicola says, I'll screenshot and read later, no need to talk it through. You can quickly bring it up. Yeah, there are some people who are actually only able to listen to what I say because they're actually visually impaired. So I do try to make sure that they actually can also get it too. So that's one of the reasons why I do it the way I do. I've had quite a few people actually really say I really appreciate the fact that you do actually read it out and rather than just flash it on the screen. So that's why I do what I do, and I know it slows everything down, but just from an inclusive perspective, I think it's probably the best way to go. So that's why I do what I do. All right, this is from Stevie, 2111 Glazeville. All right, young affluent is how I flagged it in my segmentation. Slowly changing, of course, but that's pretty much what we look at. 6,163 households, 2,289 borrowing, 2,699 renting, 2,063 properties for rent, number of property rental owners just over 2,000, quite low mortgage stress at 5.9%, 47 risking default at 2.1%, rental stress, though, is higher at 58.6%, and that's more than 1,500 households. And the investors who are stressed, 62.8%, more than 1,000. So, again, rental investor rather than owner-occupied issues in that particular postcode. Can you say something about 3079 Ivanhoe East, please? That's from Amelia. Sure can. Let's see what I can find in the database clear list. 3079. Okay. Apply. Okay. Here we go. 6,786 households, of which 2,452 are borrowing, 2,671 are renting. There are just over 2,000 properties for rent. Number of rental property owners, 1,341. Mild stress, 1,635, which translates to 66.7%. So this is a outer suburban stressed postcode area. 54 risking default 12 months at 2.2%. Rental stress is 24.1% at 647. And the investor stress is only 16.3%. So this is a mortgage stress. And I see this again and again. So in some of the outer suburban areas, it's mortgage stress itself, where people have got mortgages which are quite big relative to incomes. And as a result of that, the repayments are an issue. And of course, now they're struggling with the repayments. Okay, Mike says thanks for that contribution to Mike as well. North Curl Curl 2099. Edit. Clear list. 2099. And that one. And then apply it. Yay, it worked. Okay, here we go. 2099 DY. 16,649 households, of which 6,348 are borrowing, 7,925 are renting, 5,946 properties for rent, number of rental property owners, 5,492, mild stress, 719, severe stress, this is a real problem, 1,132, overall 29.2%, but that severe stress number, that's very high. Risk of default 12 months, 185 or 2.9%, rental stress, 4,696 at 59.3, so again, that's high. And property investors, 60.3%. So if I put that together, you know, there's a bit of mortgage stress, but it's the rental sector and it's the property investors in that particular postcode who I think are probably having the difficulties. There we go. All right, hope that's sorted that one out. Okay. Yeah. So Michael's asked an interesting question. 2567 at the top of your mortgage stress list in New South Wales, what sort of reductions in value do you see for an area like that? Well, that's very interesting, Michael. What we're seeing is that where you've got these pressures, and you know what's fascinating is that mortgage stress and property price reductions are quite often connected because people are forced to sell ultimately. We're looking in some cases at 20% plus in reductions from where they were, you know, some months ago. Not uniformly, and units more so than houses, but I do see in a number of postcodes where there are high levels of stress, significant declines in property values. And I fear it's going to get worse because what's going to happen is that later on, you know, when the banks start getting a bit more antsy with people and phone them up and say, right, you've had your mortgage repayment holiday for 6 months, but now you've got another two or three months to sort it out. You know, what's your story? What's your income? You know, what's your real income and what you're going to do? I think they're going to put a little bit of pressure on people to sell. So they don't want to foreclose, but they will probably encourage people to sell. So I expect to see quite a lot of encouragement. And that means we're going to see more properties on the market over the next few months, particularly I think up to Christmas and beyond. And that means I think that we're going to see significant falls in some of those areas. Okay. Jeremy asked about 2232, the Sutherland Shire. Let's do that one, shall we? 2232. Some of those were not looking too flash when I looked at them most recently. So let's see. Okay, here we go. All right. 13,168 households, 6,069 borrowing, 4,519 renting, properties for rent, 3,358, number of rental property owners, 4,253, mild stress, 924, 15.2%, so stress not too bad, risk of default, 114 or 1.9%, relatively low, rental stress, 2,629 at 58.2%, that's high. And that's what I'm seeing. So in that particular postcode, we've got a number of people who are in rented accommodation who are finding it very difficult to make those mortgage repayments, the rental repayments. And as a result of that, of course, quite a few property investors, 42.2% in the area, are also under pressure. So again, it's an investment story. I think we're going to see more of that ahead, unfortunately. Michael says, I like the review of specific properties. How long can banks survive with so many mortgage deferrals? Well, at the moment, the fact is that APRA has allowed them to have plenty of wriggle room, so they don't have to declare deferred mortgages as bad mortgages. How long that goes on for is the interesting question, right? So they've probably got some months. And, of course, everyone's hoping that the economy will bounce back and all this will cure itself. Probably won't. I think 3 to 6 months from now, we'll be having a more difficult conversation about the banks and about what they're going to do. Like I said, they'll be encouraging people to sell. And with regard to the first part of your comment there about you like the specific examples, yeah, we're going to do more of that next week with Edwin. So if you want to have a more detailed conversation around properties, because what I want to get from Edwin is what's going on, why this type of property is behaving the way it is and why that type of property is behaving like it is. So we'll look at some units, we'll look at some apartments, and we'll try and get some national examples. I've got 50 or 60 that Cookie Boys sent through, and we'll accumulate some more so that we can have a bit of a sort of a selection of different scenarios and different examples, because I think it brings it home, doesn't it? Otherwise, it's just very high level and theoretical. Okay. Yeah, Joseph says APRA allows banks till March 2021 to report delinquent loans as performing. Well, yes, and then what happens, right? So, you know, will APRA continue to push that further out? I mean, they have sort of, APRA has sort of said, well, you need to have a conversation with people so that you know where you are. And they've also said that we'll be starting to disclose that information to the market. So I think that, you know, middle of next year, we're going to see some of this come through. It's going to take some time to work through. And APRA has been very, very willing to flex interest-only loans. You know, fine, yeah, make some interest-only loans, not a problem. Or don't need to actually adjust your advanced models for what's happening if you've got an IRR, internal risk-rated model, which is what all the big four banks have. Just carry on, you know. So I think it will take a bit of time, but it will shake out ultimately. Now, Fiona asked an interesting question. Can you talk about the 20 billion cap per ADI? Correct. That is a very important point. So it's not widely disclosed, but the 250k deposit is limited, in theory at least, to 20 billion per bank. Now, the idea is, of course, that if a bank falls over, then the regulators will go to other banks to get contribution to be able to sort of support more than that. But there is a limit. And of course, the big banks have way more than 20 billion in terms of deposits. So how valid and how appropriate is the 250k deposit? It's, you know, it's up to 20 billion. That is something which people hasn't really got their head around. And there's very little information. If you go into the detail on the APRA site, the 20 billion is hardly mentioned. Okay, what else have we got to look at? I've got plenty of other postcode questions. I'm just going to go up to the top and just have a look, see what else we've got. We're running 9:20. Gosh, it's gone quickly. Okay. This is a lovely question from Nelly T. Any insight on the risk and return principle, given that there is probably, it's not been a riskier time since the Great Wars, yet interest return incredibly small. System is broken. It is. It is. And the system is broken fundamentally because the system is being propped up by central banks. There was some statistics that came out today that showed that there's been a 44% increase in central banks' balance sheets in the last year or so. Massive. And what that means is that basically the I don't think we are actually in a standard market at all, right? So market forces are really just being controlled by the central banks. Risk is actually not being rewarded. Returns are actually all over the place, and basically the central banks are backstopping the whole thing, particularly, of course, in the US with the Fed. Started last September with the repos. That hasn't gone away, and they're throwing more liquidity into the system. So the whole question of relative risk and return is, you know, all over the place. And, of course, the stock market's basically a high because they are assuming that the central banks will just go on piling money into the system to support everything. The question is, is that really going to work, or are we going to have essentially a point where, you know, despite all of the liquidity that's being thrown into the system starts to wobble and shake and begin to fall apart? Hard to know. Corporate bonds, look at those. I think the number of corporate defaults are likely ahead, particularly in the US. I think that we've got to look quite carefully at the derivative sector, because many of the derivatives are actually now way off their sort of midpoint in terms of their exposures. So when those come to fruition, when they're netted off, that could actually create big losses or gains, depending on which side of the transaction you are. And of course, you've got the consumer sector, and particularly in some countries like Australia, where you've got big mortgage risk as well. So there are many, many risks. And you know, the returns, if you're holding bank shares, the returns you're going to get ahead in terms of the return, the dividend returns are going to be much lower than they were previously, when in fact the risks are a lot higher. So, yeah, I agree. It's all gone, blown out the window, frankly. Okay, what else have we got? Oh, George. How many bitcoins does it take to make an 80% property crash? That is a completely impossible question, because nobody knows the value of property. Nobody knows the value of Bitcoin. So how can you put one against the other? What I can say is that I still think Bitcoin is ever more speculative than property, but property is also very speculative too at the moment. So, yeah. Okay, here's another one. I'll do this one. 3802, thanks for that. Edit, clear list, 3802, okay, add that, apply, okay. This is Endeavor Hills. Get rid of that as well, so you can see it. There we go, Endeavor Hills, 8,558 households, 4,484 borrowing, 2,389 renting, 1,786 properties for rent, a number of rental property owners, 3,153, mild rentals, mild mortgage stress, 3,488, which translates to 77.8%. High, very high. Urban fringe, of course, so what you'd expect. Risk of default, 105 over the next 12 months at 2.3%. Rental stress, 1,195 at 50%, so relatively high. Whereas stressed investors, 631, only 20%. So, again, it's a story of mortgage stress followed by rental stress. Okay, here's one from Mabmo. I don't know how you pronounce that. 2261. Thank you for the contribution as well, by the way. Appreciate that. So the old super chat works, doesn't it? 2261. Let's add that in and apply it. I don't know. Batu Bay. Where's that? That's the entrance. Oh, okay. So that's the mid-north coast, weren't it? Yeah. Mid-north coast is one that I'm particularly interested in terms of what's going on. There's a lot of pressure up there. 24,491 households, 8,747 borrowing, 11,317 renting, 8,676 properties for rent, and mild mortgage stress, 3,318 at 37.9%. Risk of default, 265 at 3%. Rental stress, 6,397 at 56.5%, so rental stress higher than mortgage stress, and 42.4% of investors are stressed, 2,996. So there you go. More on the rental side again. And I'm seeing quite a lot of pressure up on the central coast. Mortgage stress is quite high in a number of areas, and we've also got significant rental stress there because some of the financial pressures that we're seeing are quite severe. Of course, some of the tourism that would normally come through there has not, and that's definitely created an issue. W, thank you for that. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to break off from my postcodes. I'm just going to go through the rest of my presentation, which will take about 3 or 4 minutes. But I will stay on after the 9:30 and do a few more postcodes because I know that people are quite keen on that. But anyway, let's just go back to go back to the right picture. We'll get on better, won't we? Okay, that's the one I want. Okay, so let's just go back to here. So just in terms of closing out this, if you want more information about what we do, go to the DFA blog. You can sign up there and get alerts for all the things that we research. Digitalfinanceanalytics.com at blog. You can also support our work via Patreon. And if you're interested in getting the data, you can now subscribe for $50 a month plus GST and get the complete stress series each month. So that includes mortgage stress, rental stress, and investor stress for every postcode in my database. So that's a new service that we started a couple of months ago. It's been very popular. So that might be something you're interested in. And also, you can get my full data set for a month, which is a mere $500 plus GST, which, you know, some people have also gone to. But there are other levels too. So look at the Patreon program. The point about Patreon is it allows me to have a base of subscribers that actually supports us in an ongoing fashion. And that's really, really helpful at the moment because, you know, this takes time, effort, money. And in fact, every dollar we get from any of our support programs goes all back into the channel. You can also make one-off donations via PayPal, and that is used by some people. So that's an alternative, and that is also appreciated too. And you can even do Bitcoin if you really want. Not many have, but it's there. I should say, on a merch basis, I've got this design, which I created some time ago. I'll probably do some others later, but it is available, and you can actually go on the YouTube channel, and you can see the merch there, or you can go direct to Teespring. But there's mugs, and there's some shirts and bits and pieces, all with the DFA logo on. The mugs, you know, they're not cheap because it's all done in the US and you've got the exchange rate there. But a few people have regarded the DFA mug as a very prestigious thing to own. So, you know, if you're interested, you can grab that. And again, it all comes to help support the channel. Now, in terms of top hits, just a few things. The discussion I had with Salvador Babones on India, in other words, after China, what next, has been a roaring success. So go have a look at that if you've not seen it. Very interesting discussion because basically the conclusion is China was a one-off. There isn't another China out there. So and our trade relationships and our economy is too reliant on China, but there isn't an alternative. So that's a problem. Also, with John Adams, I went into detail with regards to the bail-in and the fact that APRA has been trying to stop the media covering bail-in. That show is worth watching because we go beyond bail-in and we talk more broadly about the philosophical structures that exist in the country and how it is that media, regulators, politicians are all basically steered away from talking some of the critical issues that we should be talking about. There's also a show with Robbie Barwick where we discuss the issue of lobbying for the bail-in change, so that's the, you know, including deposits. That show tells you all about what to do and how to do it. 2 weeks more before the Senate is meant to deliberate on this, so it's worth picking up the phone or sending an email, talking to your MP, and all the instructions there are on that video. I've also continued my series with CanStar's Steve Mickenbecker. Steve's really good because he's got a very good wide knowledge of all the different products that CanStar actually surveys and presents data on. And this one was on superannuation, and there are so many people who've got significant issues in super, so it's worth watching that. And then also, I spoke to Des a couple of weeks ago on innovation. This is actually an electric company over in Western Australia trying to actually innovate in the context of very difficult times. And we're going to do more innovation. I've got some other plans there. So that's there's just a few that have been very popular this month. Now, in terms of next show, 28th, next week, Edwin will be on and we'll be going through specifically some case studies on property values. So, you know, why they're up, why they're down, and those sorts of things, as well as a broader conversation with Edwin about property and what the trends are. Edwin actually holds the record for the largest number of concurrent viewers on a live stream on DFA. So we're going to try and break that next week. So mark your diaries there. The link for that show will go up in the next couple of days, and I'll be forward running it over the next little while, just cross promoting it. So be aware of that. And I think that's it, really. So with that, I'm now going to come back to the postcode, and I'll do a few more postcodes just to say that if I don't get to your postcode tonight, and you still would like an answer to a postcode, you can contact me via the DFA blog. And if you send your postcode via the contact app on the DFA blog, I will turn around and send you back maybe a day or two. It takes a little time because I get quite a few requests. But if there is that way of getting an individual postcode, I can do a two or three. More than that, it's hard to do. If you get value from the postcode stuff, do consider making a contribution, perhaps via PayPal or something, to help defray the costs. But I'm happy to do that. Okay, now this is an interesting one from Julian. Thank you for that, Julian. Haven't seen a property change hands in 3128. I don't know what 3128 is. Let's have a look, shall we? 3128. You can tell quite a lot from the data. So that's Box Hill South, which is on the outer suburbs of Victoria, right? There you go. 3128. Yep. So households 8,726. 2,557 borrowing, 4,913 renting. So renting is the thing there. 3,716 renting properties, 2,909 rental property owners. 27.2% mortgage stress, 2.7% in terms of default over 12 months, and 31% in rental stress at 1,535. And 44% of property investors in the area in difficulty. There you go. So it seems to me that this particular postcode is sort of, you know, in the doldrums, but hasn't yet really blown up completely. So I hope that's of some help. Joanne has just come up with 3122. I can't do units versus houses in this particular view. It's just not in the way that the data is controlled at the moment, but I can give you a summary. As with all of this data, there's always more ways I'd like to apply and cut the data, but you know, there's a limit to what I can actually do. So here we are, Hawthorne, 11,578. That's the number of households. 2,808 borrowing, 7,079 renting, a lot of renters, 5,421 for rent, and number of rental property owners, 2,994. 59.9% in mortgage stress, so a big number there. A lot of people with significant issues. 107 risking default at 3.8% over 12 months. Rental stress, 3,882 at 54.8%, so a significant number of people in rental stress. And boy, oh boy, we're getting the full Monty here. 1,781. 63.8% of investors. So basically, whether you're a mortgage holder, whether you are actually investing, or whether you're actually paying rent, you can see that the pressure is significant right the way across the board. And you're quite right in saying it's a wealthier suburb. It is, but of course people have bigger mortgages, because that tends to be the case when that's a more wealthy suburb, because property prices are higher. So my expectation is that Hawthorne prices are look like they're going to slide. All right, so there we go. I could quite happily spend another hour going through, but I'm not going to, because I'm running out of smoke. So I just want to say thank you very much indeed for your time this evening. Oh, there's another one. I will do that one, because somebody's actually put some money in the tin. Thank you very much, Emmeline. 3194. I'll just do that one now. 3194. Oops. That's Mentone. Let's do that there. Okay. So that's over here. I haven't taken that one off. So Mentone, 6,000 households, 2,200 borrowing, 2,700 renting, 2,000 and just over 2,000 available for rent, 23.5% mortgage stress. That's pretty low. 3.1% default over 12 months. That's quite high, 693. 25% in rental stress and 32% in investor stress. So relative to some of the others, and I left the other one up because you can see some of the differences. Inner suburbs, Hawthorne, 63.38% compared with 32.3% on the urban fringe. So there you go. Okay. So I want to say thank you very much for spending some time with me this evening. I hope you found it useful. I haven't got to all the questions. I apologize. You understand that I never can. Oh dear. 3222. I'm not going to get away, am I? 3222. Okay, I'll do it. Sorry, I missed that one. 3222. I've got so many people now sending me money to do it. Clifton Springs. This is the last one, okay? 6,479. 2,734 borrowing. 2,059 renting. 1,500 properties for rent. 22.2% mortgage stress. That's pretty low. 23.5% in rental stress. Again, pretty low. And 20.9% in investors. So it's relatively benign relative to some of the others that I've seen. So there you go. That's it. I'm really going to stop now because I've run out of smoke, and I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you very much. Should I also make the point that after Edwin, the week after that, it'll be me talking about the latest month data. So I'll get a monthly data. The date after that is one for your diary, because I have a great debate between Robbie Barwick and Salvatore Bibones relating to China. And bearing in mind what happened last time Robbie came on, well, that'll be quite a marathon. So mark your diary there. I'll be highlighting that ahead. But anyway, next time Edwin's on, thank you for your time tonight. Keep safe, take care, wear a mask. And I do thank you for spending some time with me this evening. It's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. We'll see you next time.